This is December 30th, 1968. We're recording the oral history of Mary Rowley, the state public health nurse, state of Alaska, 1951 to 1968. We are at 917 8th Avenue, Fairbanks. It's the Tano Yukon Historical Society recording.
Now, this is Mary Rowley speaking, and I came to Alaska originally in 1948 with the Episcopal Mission and was stationed on the Lower Yukon. I came from Rochester, New York. I was born and received my education in Rochester, New York. I was born on September 21st, 1906, and lived in Rochester until about 1940, at the beginning of the war, when I went out to make my fortune in other places. I came to Alaska from Miami, Florida, where I had been working as a first aid nurse in Pan American Airlines in the hangars. My mother was of Irish parents. Her name was Catherine Maley. In Ireland, my grandmother was O'Maley, and she always said she dropped the O in the pond as she came over. My father was of Holland Dutch parents with a mixture of English, so that's probably where the name Rowley came in. My father was a finisher of pianos for the American Piano Company and worked for them until he was 75 years old. I am not married, so there are no children. I have been a nurse since 1923 when I went in training in Rochester, New York. I graduated in 1929. The two extra years were due to having had tuberculosis after my mother's death of the same disease. My hobbies are reading, number one, and reading mostly history and original stories of the beginnings of places, all countries, nothing in particular stands out from another country. I just enjoy history. I also knit, and I enjoy gardening and flowers. I came to Alaska in 1948 as a missionary nurse for the Episcopal Church. I don't know why I came. I really don't know what made me decide to come, except that I listened to Deaconess Bedell telling stories of how she helped to build Stevens Village and the village of Tanana with her own hammer and nails, and the thrilling stories of coming down the Yukon River on a raft with her bonnet strings streaming behind her made it so exciting that I just opened my mouth and asked if they ever used medical missionaries. And from then on, I was in. I arrived in Alaska August 15th, 1948. Even though I had worked for Pan American Airlines, I had not done much air travel, and I came all the way to Seward without getting on an airplane. And in fact, all the way to Anchorage. And when I arrived in Anchorage, there was a message saying I was to fly to Anvik. I traveled with Northern Consolidated Airlines as far as Aniak and then chartered a plane. The plane, Little CB, piloted by Jimmy Hoffman, one of the best pilots in Alaska, in my opinion, and that's strictly personal, came in to get me in Aniak, and when I saw the pontoons, I just knew I wasn't going to be able to fly in it because I was so afraid of the water. He finally told me I either went out and got in the plane or I would not be going to Anvik because they had to land on the water. I was very frightened, and we flew, it seemed like, over the top of the world, going over to Anvik, and landed in the Yukon River, a very choppy river that particular day, and taxied into the beach. When I got out of the airplane, I was greeted by the priest there, and I immediately asked him where the cemetery was, because I was going up and mark out a site for my grave. I would never leave Anvik if I had to get in another airplane. About a year later, our male pilot, who was Tony Schultz, came in and said I needed to get out of the village and get away for a little while, and he took me on the remainder of his run down to Marshall. We took off from Anvik, sat down at Holy Cross, took off from Holy Cross, sat down at Paiute, took off from Paiute, sat down at Russian Mission, and took off from Russian Mission to Marshall. We had dinner with the Gwynns, who at that time ran the store there, and then we came back the same way with all these stops. By the time I got back to Anvik, my fear of airplanes was all gone, and I've been riding in them ever since up here. My life in Anvik probably was the most wonderful 3 years of my whole life. I learned to do without so many things and really were not lonesome for any of them. I did not see an electric light in 3 years. I did not see an automobile. I did not see so many things, especially water running out of a faucet. I had my own dog team. I hauled my own ice. I hauled my own water in the summertime. I learned to knit a fishnet and had it under the ice to catch fish in the wintertime. I had to cut fish for my dogs and smoke them, 2,300 salmon every summer for my dogs and myself. I learned to sew skin boots. The people taught me this. I went there with an idea of teaching the poor, deprived Indians how to live properly, and instead they taught me. This is a part of my life that will always be outstanding. The people of Anvik are very close to my heart. There was one sort of matriarch in the village, Agatha Chase, who taught me all the things, even taught me how to snowshoe, and sat and laughed just as hard as I did when I went in the snowbank head first, trying to go as fast as she had been going. I learned to set traps and knew how to set spring pole traps to catch rabbits. I did so many things that the people in the great outside know nothing about. And when I go outside to visit, and believe me, they're very short visits, and tell these tales, people always end up by saying, well, what do you do for fun? And this annoys me very much because it was all fun. At the end of 3 years, Bishop Gordon felt that it was certainly time for me to go outside and visit my family and to sort of get, I guess we would say civilized again. And I didn't want to go. I had had such a wonderful 3 years in this village that I wanted to stay right there. And I was the person who had put blinders on. I could only see the people and the aches and the pains and the needs of the village of Anvik. I could not see any of the rest of Alaska because, of course, I didn't know anything about the rest of Alaska. And we had so many needs in Anvik which were not being met. This was a mission village. Consequently, the BIA did not enter into it, even though they were 100% Indian. Because the mission supported the school, because the mission supported the medicine, because the mission took care of the people, the BIA did not visit. We did not have a doctor the 3 years I was there. The only nursing was what I did with the meager medicines that I had on hand. Bishop Gordon felt that I should go out and meet my family. Okay. And I didn't really want to go. The Alaska Department of Health had a workshop in conjunction with the Bureau of Indian Affairs Medical Department, and all the nurses from both agencies were having a workshop in Anchorage. The mission nurses were invited. There were three of us, one at Allakaket, Jean Aubrey at Nenana, and myself at Anvik. Jean and I managed to get there. The lady from Allakaket did not get in to that meeting. But we went in and had a marvelous time meeting all these girls from all over Alaska. At the end of the workshop, I told Dorothy Whitney, who was the chief nurse in Alaska at that time, that I was having to give up and go home because my three-year assignment was up and I really didn't want to go. At that time, she asked me if I would be interested in transferring with the Territorial Department of Health, and I jumped at the chance and had the great opportunity of helping to open the itinerant nursing service in the Bethel area. There were two other nurses, Edna Bakken and Amity Porter, who came from outside, very well trained, very good public health nurses, and we divided up the Bethel area. At the time, each of us was given a list of villages, and we each had 10 or 12 villages. By the time we covered the area that these villages encompassed, we each had around 20 villages because we found villages that Juno didn't even know existed. We were doing mostly case finding. The, of course, tuberculosis incident was so high that we felt it was practically hopeless. And when we talked to patients about going to the hospital and to get their consent to go to the hospital, it was rather tragic, the expression on their faces, because we only had 175 tuberculosis beds at Mount Edgecombe Hospital, and this was for the whole of Alaska. So it nowhere near sufficed the need. We made out quantities of papers and quantities of referrals, and by the time there was a vacant bed, the patients were long gone. I remember one doctor who sent a telegram asking for a particular man to be sent to the hospital immediately, and I sent a telegram back saying the man had died a year before. So then he sent another name, and I wrote back, or telegraphed back, and said the man had died 6 months before. And then he sent the third telegram, and he said, send any available male. At that point, any man or woman that you sent would have had TB. The incident of crippled children in these villages was terrific. The amount of TB spines and TB hips and congenital hips and congenital birth defects was such a high rate that, if you were to tell it today, people just wouldn't believe you. We made out all these referrals, and because of the lack of hospital beds, very few of them got in. It was not until 54 that when the ANHS hospital opened that we were able to get part of these people in. Many of them had already gone on. After 2 years in the Bethel area, we had an investigation in Alaska from Washington, D.C. by the United States Public Health Service to find out the needs, the medical needs in Alaska, and where Public Health Service could help and what they could do to alleviate a lot of the backlog of all these referrals that we were making. The Surgeon General came up with quite a group of investigators, and among them was the Ruth Fielding, who was the head of the Public Health Service nursing group. And when she got to Juneau and looked over the roster of the territorial nurses, she found here was a nurse in the field carrying a little black bag, and she was not qualified. I did not have my college degree. I had not had public health training. All I had was the urge to help others and the little bit of experience I had had at ANVIC. And so the territory offered me a scholarship to go back to the University of Washington and get my degree and qualify myself. This was a great honor, and I was very happy to accept it and went out to the University of Washington for a year, probably the most traumatic year of my life. I, for one thing, was much too old to start cracking books. It had been 30 years since I'd studied as such, and to suddenly have to take all these classes and write all these term papers was a little bit more than I could take. I was so lonesome for Alaska that many times I would ask for the key to the trunk room and go up and open my trunk and pull out the sealskin boots and the furs that I had packed away and just sit there and cry and smell the odors that would take me back to Alaska. When I returned to Alaska after 12 months of study, I was sent to St. Lawrence Island. It was very hard to understand why all that study and all of those papers were necessary to go to St. Lawrence Island. St. Lawrence Island is a mecca for research people. The people on the island very seldom go anywhere, and so we had much, much company that came in for all different kinds of research. We had cardiac research, we had skin research, we had blood research, we had research on walrus and seals and whales, and some of it is still going on. St. Lawrence Island is a very barren island, 150 miles off the coast of Nome, but the people there are very wonderful people. They, at that time, were so anxious to learn, especially the people in Savunga. When I would visit in Savunga, these people would sort of chomp at the bit if I didn't start adult classes in health practically the minute I got there. And one time, because I had a lot of paperwork, I neglected them for 3 days, and the chief came and said, "You've been here 3 days and you didn't teach us anything. What's the matter with you?" And another time when I taught a midwifery class and I got to the end of the book and said, "This is the last class." And one of the women said, "You're going to be here 2 more weeks. Don't you know anything more?" These are the sort of words we like to hear. This makes us know that they're interested. This makes us know that they want to learn. If a person wants to learn, he can learn. If you force yourself on someone, you just waste time. In all of these places, our case finding was tremendous. At one time on St. Lawrence Island, Dr. Helen Whaley came out, the first time that a doctor had ever sat down and really examined, complete examinations of all children under 16 years old. These children had hemoglobin tests to find out the strength of their red blood cells, and they had urine tests, and Dr. Whaley examined every one of them from top to bottom. She found so many heart murmurs, and several congenital heart anomalies that she began to question herself. And I remember she said, I'm going to quit. I'm finding too many. I think I'm hearing things. But she wasn't. They were right. And when we sent them in for cardiac clinics, they were proven that she was very, it was proven that she was very right. She had been case finding, and these children did need help. We had cases of club feet where the children were sent down to Mount Edgecombe for orthopedic surgery. And it was rather interesting to watch when these children were put on an airplane. The expression on the parents' faces, I wonder how many parents on the outside could stand and watch their children climb into an airplane and fly away into the wide blue yonder and not know if they were coming back. And in those days, our budgets were so small that if the children or if an adult expired in the hospital, there was no money in the budget to fly a body back home, so that they were buried someplace far, far away from their ancestors, with a race of people who believe so much in their ancestors and in the life hereafter. This must have been very difficult for them. Finally, after I went to St. Lawrence Island to stay 6 months, this is what I think is very interesting. I was to do a special job in 6 months, but it couldn't be done in 6 months, and so I stayed a little over 2 years. And then I transferred to the Matanuska Valley. This was an entirely different kind of nursing. Our health center was in the hospital. My work with the people was mostly concerned with white people and very well educated people, but the thing that they all had in common was that they were so proud of their children and they were so anxious to have someone tell them their children were healthy that my well baby clinics and well children's clinics, preschool clinics, grew by leaps and bounds from a half day once a month to 2 days every 2 weeks. It was really, this was the one connecting link between medical work in the in these communities and the people was to do these to hold these well baby clinics. We have a film in our state library called All My Babies, and this is a midwifery film, but I sort of liked the expression All My Babies. And so when I held well baby clinics, eventually each mother would bring a picture of her baby and we'd put it on the wall. And you know, it was rather interesting when the other mothers would come in and they'd look over all those pictures. And when I left Palmer, I think we had over 100 babies on that wall. Palmer, of course, was a city and we had 3 resident doctors and they resented very much certain things that the public health nurses were allowed to do, and so I had to watch myself very carefully in referring all kinds of medical treatments and things to the doctor so that he had a part in this work. Very often I did the case finding and turned it over to him. One child that was found quite by accident, a baby, that came in and just had looked like blue lips. And I asked the mother to take her over to the doctor, or take him over to the doctor. And sure enough, he had a big hole in his heart and he had to be sent out for open heart surgery. The valley was most interesting. I went to Wasilla. I visited the farms. I learned all about cows and the excellent dairy herds that they had in the valley. I learned a great deal about milk and how it is handled and taken care of through the Matanuska Valley Creamery. I helped some of the poor farmers with some of their medical needs. and traveled all around that area. I also traveled that new highway, but it wasn't a highway when I was there. It was very much a muddy place on the new road up to Talkeetna, and driving a state or territorial car up that way, the men would usually throw up their hands when they saw me coming because they knew they were going to have to pull me out of the mud. After 3 years in the Matanuska Valley, I went to Sitka. I transferred down to Southeast and was stationed in the city of Sitka. Here again was an entirely new part of my training, and I like to call my work in Alaska a training because I learned, the whole thing was a learning experience. And in Sitka, I worked with some of the finest organizations. This was my first time to work closely with different social organizations. The Lions Club of Sitka bought a movie projector for the health center so that I could take health movies around to all the organizations and help to promote the health work and the health needs of the communities of Sitka. I visited the logging camps, and I rode the trucks out into the hills and the mountains while they were logging to see just how they did it. And I visited the little school in the logging camp, 8 grades in one little room, and there were only 12 students. You wonder sometimes how a teacher will isolate himself to work in these real small places because they're so isolated with no extracurricular activities whatever. In Sitka, I worked very closely with the Soroptimist Club and became very socially minded. It seemed to me I became a joiner because I got into everything. But all of it was to better the medical work in Sitka, and a very good rapport was maintained with these organizations, with the Mount Edgecombe School, with Sheldon Jackson School, with the Mount Edgecombe Hospital. The state was brought into the picture, and everyone became more and more aware of what we were trying to do through the state agency. It was quite an honor the first time that I was invited to go to Sheldon Jackson School and help hold morning devotions. I think the fact that everyone knew that I had once been a missionary in Anvik, whether I was a good one or a poor one, they felt that I could help with religious activities in all these different villages and communities that I had lived in. After about 3 years at Sitka, I felt as though my feet were getting webbed. It rained so much, and while the terrain of Sitka is very beautiful, and the beautiful greens and different shades of green in the hills and on the mountains and the beautiful flowers were very lovely, and it was a lovely place to live. I felt that I needed to get out where I had a little more sunshine and a little more chance to do more things than go paddling around in the rain with overshoes and a raincoat all the time. And so the Department of Health asked me if I would take over the nursing services of a new project in Juneau. I really think that they felt, because of all these gray hairs that I was accumulating and all these years of service, that I deserved a desk job for my declining years. I went over to Juneau to help with the project of WellBe, Many of you will remember the name, perhaps Welby is always distinguished by a little bumblebee. It's the Welby. And this was an immunization project that had been started through a federal grant to try and immunize all of the people of the United States. And many of the states bought this grant, hoping to bring up the standard and the census of the people who were completely immunized. I had two nurses working with me, Mrs. Olive Auld, who had been a supervisor in the Anchorage Health District, and another girl who had been working as a public health nurse out in the field but had quit and come into Juneau to live. We were supervised by a man who had never had any medical training. He was a statistician and knew very little about nursing or what public health nurses did. We also had a publicity woman and two secretaries. Well, we started out our clinics by working on the city of Juneau, and in 5 weeks gave 27,000 immunization shots to the people of Juneau. We then moved down to Ketchikan, and we were in Ketchikan for 5 weeks, and we didn't do quite so well there. Then we came back to Juneau to sort of evaluate ourselves and see where we could improve some of our techniques and our program, and we planned to go all the way to Barrow by the 1st of September, but the supervisor decided that we were not going to go out for 6 months. He wanted us to sit and make a color book for little children in the first grade to color, to sort of impress them with their immunization shots. I couldn't imagine myself sitting quietly in an office drawing bumblebees. And so I said as much, and I told him that nurses were used to working with their hands, and he said it was about time we learned to work with our minds, and I thought that was a good time to quit. So I used my mind, and I went upstairs and asked for a public health nurse's job in the field where I could be closer to the patient and closer to the native people whom I love so much. Helen Hartigan, who was the chief nurse at this time in Juneau, gave me a list of about 20 vacancies that she had at that particular time, and this was the first day of August, and told me to take my pick. So I chose the community of McGrath as headquarters, and I covered about 8 villages out of McGrath. I arrived in McGrath on the 15th of August, and I sort of had a feeling of coming home. I was back out in the bush with native people, and this is the group that I enjoy working with most. I traveled to the lower Yukon and considered it a great privilege to have again the village that I started with many years ago. I went back to Anvik, and here again, it was like coming home. The people welcomed me. They were so glad to see me. Everyone had grown older, just as I had grown older. Many were gone, but the children that used to play on my kitchen floor now brought their own babies in for immunizations. The changes in the villages were tremendous. If I hadn't worked in these villages, I probably wouldn't have noticed it. But in about 15 years, the changes were so striking that it was very difficult to accept. No longer were they an uneducated group. Most of the young married couples had been away to school for, some of them were high school graduates, some of them had been for a year or 2 years, but all of them had a fairly good education. In none of these villages did I need to work through an interpreter. They all understood and spoke English, where 15 years before I very often used an interpreter. The changes for the good in the village of Anvik and in Grayling and Shagluck and Holy Cross were that the housing, one thing was the housing was better. They had 2 and 3 rooms where previously they had all lived in one room. They had electricity. Practically every home had electricity now. And the other thing which makes them very modern was that nearly all homes had propane gas stoves, and they were able to cook and bake. And they said much better. I still like the old wood stove to bake my bread in. The village of Grayling was interesting because this was a federal project. This is the old village of Holokachuk, which was on the Anoko River, and the waters were washing it away. The Anoko River and a slough behind the village were gradually closing in and washing Holokachuk away. And so the community of Grayling decided to move out to the Yukon, where the fishing was better in the summertime. They all had their fish camps out there anyway in the summertime. And so they built their village at Grayling. A lovely little place where the Grayling River comes down, and as you may suspect from the name, the Grayling fish, a form of trout, was very plentiful. The Bureau of Indian Affairs built a beautiful $100,000 school with residence for the teachers. The federal housing went in and helped these people with their homes, and it's one of the few villages on the Yukon where the people have painted their houses on the outside all different colors. The people were very proud of this village. When I went into the village for the first time, the old men came to get me to show me their homes, and their wives were so proud to take me into the bedroom where they had a real bed. They'd never had real beds before, and they had a bedspread on the bed. This was the most important thing to show me, was the sheets and the pillowcases and the bedspread. They still use wood to heat with and the old drum stoves, but they had their propane gas for their cook stoves. Since my first visit to Grayling, federal people have gone in and helped them to dig sewers and to put in a water line from 2 wells that were dug. And now each home in Grayling has running water and a disposal system of sorts so that the sewers carry off all the waste. They are still, however, using honey buckets. They haven't gotten to the flush toilets, but they will. Shagluck was another interesting village over on the Anoko River. This was a village of about 150 people. Very, very poor Indian people. They had never progressed very far in school or in educating themselves. The old school law that you went to school till you were 16 still more or less holds. There are a few going out to high school. It is very hard for them to accommodate themselves in the high schools. Many of them don't stay very long, although we have 2 girls from Shagluck that have gone to the University of Alaska and graduated. These people, again, like Grayling, were being squeezed out of or washed out of their old homes. And maybe this is a good thing for Shagluck. because the homes were getting so old and so dilapidated and sinking down so far in the mud that they weren't much good anymore. And so 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, they started moving 3 miles down the Anoka River. They found a place up on a plateau at the foot of a mountain, but high enough from the river so that the floods will not wash them out. The Bureau of Indian Affairs put in a new school again, $175,000, to outfit this school, a two-classroom school with a very good clinic and a visitor's quarters, plus generators that would supply electricity, plenty of electricity, to run deep freeze and refrigerators. They had a beautiful kitchen for their hot lunch program and a big multi-purpose room with a stage at one end with all different colored electric lights so that they could put on little plays and things in the school. The teachers' quarters were very lovely, 3 bedrooms in the teachers' quarters, which is most unusual in most of the schools. Then the people moved their cabins down. Some of them built new cabins. Some of them that had new cabins in the old community knocked them down and brought them log by log 3 miles down the river to put them up again. They worked together. I'm not sure how much of this was backed by the federal housing. I know that the men did get paid for moving the widows and the blind and the helpless so that they all got moved down to the new village. One of the other villages that I visited was Holy Cross, and Holy Cross has long been a large community on the lower Yukon of about 350 to 400 people. At one time, they had a large boarding school here, and when I first came to Alaska and was stationed at Anvik, Holy Cross had as many as 3 or 4 priests, plus about 20 Sisters of St. Anne that operated a boarding school for orphan children. And it was pretty well self-sufficient. The older boys and the men could go out in the fall and get bear and moose and ptarmigan and grouse and rabbits, and they fished. The children in the orphanage fished all summer to cut enough fish for them to eat in the winter. They had huge gardens. They raised all their potatoes and their carrots and their turnips and beets. They worked hard, and these children were taught to be quite self-sufficient. Many of them married, and here was perhaps the first place in Alaska that we found intermarriage of Eskimo and Indian. And many times I think that we of different agencies are very prone to say that the Eskimo and Indian do not get along together. And we use this as an excuse for families who have disagreements. But this is not true. In Anvik, where they have been so integrated in school, they have grown up to be integrated in their marriages, and they get along very well. It's usually some other reason that families have marital problems than the fact that one is Eskimo and one is Indian. The people at Holy Cross are a very close people. They work very well together for such a large community. In these last few years, Holy Cross has deteriorated quite a bit, mostly because the young people have gone off to school and then do not return, and the old people do not have the strength to go out and cut logs and build new houses and to build up their community or to keep it up. But in their hearts, they're a very wonderful people to know. They're a very wonderful people to work with, and they're most cooperative. I remember a couple of years ago, when I hit that very dangerous age of 60, I celebrated my birthday in Holy Cross. And in the morning, one of the old men came to see me, and I told him that he was complaining about how old he was. And I said, well, today I'm that age when you don't tell anyone anymore how old you are. He said, is it your birthday? And I said, yes. And well, and he couldn't believe I was as old as I told him I was. And so nothing more was said. But that evening, I was invited to the community hall where they were going to turn on their new electric plant for the first time. And I took some of the sisters from the, I remember a couple of years ago, when I hit that very dangerous age of 60, I celebrated my birthday in Holy Cross. And in the morning, one of the old men came to see me, and I told him that he was complaining about how old he was. And I said, well, today I'm that age when you don't tell anyone anymore how old you are. He said, is it your birthday? And I said, yes. And well, and he couldn't believe I was as old as I told him I was. And so nothing more was said. But that evening, I was invited to the community hall where they were going to turn on their new electric plant for the first time. And I took some of the sisters from the convent down with me. And when we walked in the door, it was a surprise birthday party for their nurse. And they had cake and Kool-Aid, and everyone gave me some kind of a little gift. The old man that had gone around and told everybody all about it gave me a box of candy. And some of the others put a dollar bill in an envelope and told me to buy what I would like. One of the women gave me a pair of hand-knit mittens. It was a grand get-together of 300 people, and we danced and had a real good time. The Roman Catholic priest, Father McNeil, and the little sisters all stayed, and we really had a grand time on my birthday. Since then, each year they remember, and I get birthday cards, even handmade cards from the third and fourth grade. I enjoyed Holy Cross very much. It was a pleasure to work there. One of the other villages that I had while working out of McGrath was the village of Nicolai, and this was probably one of our last frontier villages, our last little primitive villages. They hadn't had a school very long. They had had a native teacher for 2 or 3 years, and then they got the state teacher came in, and a couple, and were there a year. And every year they got another teacher because it was so difficult to work with these people. Teachers nowadays expect everyone to speak English. And when they got in there with people that didn't really want to go to school, they lost interest and they felt that it was too difficult, and they would only stay 1 year. It is very hard to accomplish very much work with the native people if you're only there 1 year. They don't even know you. You don't have their confidence. They don't relax and work with you well. You must stay more than 1 year. Now they have a teacher, a couple who are on their third year there, and the relaxed atmosphere in the village and the good times that are had by all is just tremendous. The work is wonderful. The more children are going out to high school, more children are finishing the eighth grade. There is more interest in the classes. Last year, everyone in the village had the flu, and at Christmas time, and they had talked so much about Santa Claus, and then everyone was in bed with a very severe flu. And so the teacher fixed his sleigh to look like Santa's sleigh, and his wife took the part of the reindeer, and they took gifts around to every individual house, and he dressed all up like Santa Claus and said, ho, 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 when he knocked at the door. And do you know that some of the older people actually thought that was Santa Claus? And one woman said to me,
I was so surprised and I was so sick that I forgot to say thank you for the present. These, again, are wonderful people to work with because you see them growing. You can see their minds growing, the way they reason things out, the way they conduct themselves in their meetings. I love to go to their council meetings and hear them discuss what they should do or what they should not do and how much responsibility they're going to accept in their growing up. At one time, the teacher in this school asked the children in the eighth grade to write a theme on any subject that they wished to. And this was a real eye-opener for all of us, because on my next visit, he handed me one of the themes. And a 15-year-old boy had chosen for his theme the subject of alcohol. Alcohol has become a terrific subject in all the villages. They are all becoming very deteriorated because of the extreme use of and misuse of alcohol. Fine young men are becoming mentally retarded and mentally incompetent because of the use of alcohol. At this particular time, this boy wrote a theme on this, which gave us an insight. I do not feel that these were his words exactly. It sounded in the reading as though he was repeating what had perhaps been discussed in a village meeting, in a home meeting, or in his own home among men sitting around talking about how we are trying to teach them to be more moderate in their use of alcohol. He said that he felt that no one had any right to tell anyone how much alcohol they could drink, and that if a boy 12 or 13 years old wanted to drink alcohol, that was the boy's business and that no one had any right to take it away from him. He said that he felt that people were really minding the business of alcohol too much, that it should be allowed, they should be allowed to have as much as they want, and that he could do anything he wanted to with it. I made a copy of this theme because I really was rather shocked. And I felt that it gave an insight to the natives' feelings about what we think help him with, and he feels that we are trying to hinder him from. I sent this copy to my supervisor because I didn't know what else to do with it, and I felt that someone should read it. I was very interested to learn this past summer at the Alaska Medical Association meeting that the superintendent of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute read my memo, because he too felt as I do that this gave an inside picture to the thinking of the native people in regards to alcohol, that perhaps we're making a big fuss over nothing. And yet, on the other hand, when you see fine people who literally commit suicide, shoot themselves, walk into the river, and kill themselves, drown, because of the overuse of alcohol, we feel that we should do something, but what is it? The people of Nikolai are becoming very advanced in some of the things that they're doing. In a very few years, they have cleaned up their village. They have built better homes, most of them with two or three rooms. They last year dug a well and put a pitcher pump over it. And when I asked them what was going to keep the dirt and the snow and everything else from blowing in it, the next time I went up there, they had built a little log cabin over it so that they could keep it as clean as possible. They had cleaned up their graveyard. They had straightened up their the crosses on their graveyard. They had cleaned up their Russian church, and this village is all Russian Orthodox, one of the few that are left. And they had, in quite a few ways, had improved their village. The school teacher had not actually rolled up his sleeves and done anything, but he had made suggestions. They had built a playground for the children. They had put in teeter-totters and swings. They even built a baseball diamond with a backstop that was constructed of all little willows, one on top of the other, because they had no lumber. I feel that Nikolai has a great potential. They have several children in high school now, and especially girls. One of the girls that one teacher felt was a little bit backward and perhaps would not make a go of it at Mount Edgecombe, where the standards are a little higher, was sent all the way down to Chilocco because this has a reputation of being a vocational school. And she wrote back to me very happily and said that besides her studies, she was learning to wash dishes, and that if she came back next year, she would learn to wait on table. I imagine that someday this particular girl will be a star waitress in Alaska. Around the McGrath area, I also visited some of the gold mines, and this was my first contact with this sort of work. It was sort of fun to watch the dredges and the earth being turned over and the amount of gold that came out. To me, such small quantities, but the people were very happy with what they were getting. They worked the gold mines in the summertime, and one family moves into McGrath in the winter so their children can go to school. The other family goes out to Miami, Florida, where they own property out there. But gold mining in the summertime is a very, very difficult job. However, I like to go over there to go fishing, and the fishing was unusually good in both of these places where they use so much water, and there were lakes and streams and freshwater streams that were fed from the mountains around there. After 4 years in McGrath, and I should perhaps tell you that while there I had the first great accident in my life. One time when I was on St. Lawrence Island, I was partially frozen when we became lost in the mountains, but to my knowledge, I had no repercussions from it. In McGrath, I had a what I call real accident. I was getting ready to speak at the school and to do some work in hemoglobin testing, and I usually took my little hemoglobinometer over to the school once a year and taught the children how to poke the end of their finger and draw the blood on a slide and look at it through a little microscope that I carried with me. They enjoyed doing this, and we had quite a talk about good blood and iron and a lot of other things. So I was preparing this little class, and I needed a blood plate out of one of the books that was on the top shelf, and I jumped up on my desk chair to get it, and the chair slid out from under me, and I came down on my back and broke 6 ribs. I was pretty sure one rib was broken, and I sat in my chair all day and did my desk work. And that evening, some friends came to see me and told me about a particular splint that I could get that would help me. And so I asked one of the girls, who happened to be a nurse, to call my supervisor the next day and ask her to send me out one of these rib cage splints. Well, she called the supervisor, and of course the supervisor said this was an occupational injury and I should come in and have an x-ray. I went into Anchorage and had the x-ray. The results were that I spent 4 weeks in Providence Hospital, 6 fractured ribs, a ruptured diaphragm, and which required major surgery, And 24 hours after the surgery, I had my first coronary heart attack with cardiac arrest. If the doctor hadn't been standing by the side of the bed, I probably wouldn't be here talking now. After 4 weeks, I took 4 weeks leave to recuperate in, and I spent it in the Matanuska Valley, and then came back to work. I worked full-time, full blast, and had to make up for the time I'd lost, I thought, and completed another year and a half in McGrath. Then because one can stay too long in a place, and because I feel very strongly about nurses and how much they can give to their communities in a certain length of time, I applied for a transfer to a new area. The people in the villages needed a new face to work with and some new ideas, and I needed some new faces to work with and some new problems. I asked for a transfer in February and then took myself on a vacation, the first vacation I'd had in 3 years outside of my illness. And I went on a very fabulous trip to the South Sea Islands in February and went down to the Tahitians and the two Samoa Islands and Fiji, and then traveled the length of New Zealand and visited the Maoris. And this was most interesting to me, because the Maori Polynesian group are so much like our Tlingit and Haida Indians. They have totem poles, they have inside totems, outside totems, and their stories, their folk stories, are the same as the Tlingits and the Haidas. They have the raven, and they have the frog woman, and they have all the stories that were told as our southeastern native people, Indian people, tell them. I was so fascinated that I asked the woman who was conducting us around the Maori village about it, and she said, "Oh, yes, we are all related." And she said, "Some people feel that we came down across China and across the Polynesian Islands over here, and some other people think that we went north and went across the ice bridge and came down through Canada and United States and all the way down South America." And just as Theda Hall stated in his book, Kon-Tiki, that we sailed across the Pacific this way. She said, "Whichever way it is, we are all related, and we have all told the stories down through the ages." It was very fascinating. We went on down to the southern part of New Zealand and up onto the Tasman Glacier. And, of course, a lot of this was old stuff to me, but to the people in our group, they were fascinated, flying in a small bush plane, getting out on the Tasman Glacier and making snowballs with high heels on. Then we went over to Australia and traveled up the coast of Australia, and I had an opportunity of visiting in the center of Australia to visit the Flying Doctors and the Flying Nurses. This is an organization very much as our own. They aren't as up to date, they haven't progressed as far as we have, but they cover a terrific territory. And these doctors fly out to emergencies and fly out to small communities. The nurses fly with them. They give immunizations, and believe it or not, they were just starting Sabin vaccine, the oral polio vaccine. They were just starting it down there. They haven't gotten to the measles vaccine yet. They were hoping to have it next year. And think how far we've come, with almost every child from 1 year to 16 years in Alaska has had their measles vaccine. And speaking of all these vaccines, you know our rate, our death rates and our statistics in Alaska have just, well, there's something you never expect. When I came to work for this great territory 20 years ago, I never dreamed that I would live to to see the decrease in tuberculosis, the decrease in crippled children, the decrease in epidemics that I have seen in such a short time. When I worked in the Bethel area, 89% of the population was active positive tuberculosis, and now it's less than 1%. Every family was touched with a crippled child of some kind, TB spines or TB hips or some kind of a crippling hereditary or otherwise disease. And now we seldom find them. We don't see the terrific things that we used to see. When I was on St. Lawrence Island, we had, there is no one in Savunga today. In the village of Savunga, there is not a person with a birth date in 1949. It was a huge measles epidemic, and the children all died. They all died, every one of them. And there's row on row of little tiny graves in the cemetery of the babies that died that were born in 1949. Now we don't have that anymore. The rates, the statistics are way down. We have done a tremendous job in Alaska in a very short time with a group of people that were truly a dedicated people that were interested in doing things for others. Well, back to my transfer from McGrath, I finally had the opportunity to come to Fairbanks. I had never worked in the Fairbanks area, and I felt that this was a new learning experience for me. The area that was assigned to me is the Tanana area. I started Rampart, Manly Hot Springs, Tanana, Huslia, Hughes, Ruby, Galena, Koyukuk, Nulato, and Caltag. This, again, is a different group of people. Many of these villages, such as Caltag, Nulato, Koyukuk, Galena, Ruby, have all had very, very close contact with the military, white people of the mines that used to be in Nulato and Ruby and Galena. Now the military is in Galena. And they have become, these natives have become much more worldly, and they're very modern, and they know all the latest things that are out. They're quite used to television. They go into Galena and can see the television that is put out by the Air Force there. They wear the latest things. The girls are wearing mini skirts, and the boys are quite the Beatles. They know all the latest songs and the latest dances, and it's rather fun to go to some of these dances and see the little tiny children getting up and doing the frug and the watusi. I just can't understand it, but here again, I feel that I'm very much born 30 years too soon. It's hard for me to accept these things. Years ago, it was hard for the native to accept me. Now I'm finding it very hard to accept what's being introduced into some of these villages. Some of the things in summarizing some of the things that I have noticed the most in the 20 years that I've been here are the advances, as I have said before, in medical work, the advances in the mental abilities and capabilities of the native people, how quickly they have learned to adapt to our ways and to the things that we have tried to teach them. They still retain a great deal of their old-time thinking, but the young generation growing up now has been so indoctrinated into our schools that they are able to accept many of our ways of life, some good, some bad. I feel that there is a great potential in the Native, that they're going to go a long way in governing themselves. I have a very definite feeling about much of the help, or so-called help, that we have given them. I feel that our hearts are very full and that we want to do all we can for this particular group of people, but I wonder if we are really evaluating what we are doing. I feel that we very definitely give too much. I feel that the Native in some of the villages, some of the more modern villages, is losing his sense of his pride, his pride in his village, his pride in his family, his pride in himself. He has become a person who expects and accepts all of these gifts and does not want to return in any way or help himself in any way. And I bring to mind now the man in the village that I visited not too long ago that was talking about his people, and he sat for a couple of hours discussing with me what was happening to his people. And he said, now we're going to pay and be paid. We're going to be paid for everything we do, and we're going to have regular union wages. And then he would reiterate, we're going to pay and be paid. But when I tried to pin him down as to what he was going to pay, he didn't want to tell me. At least he couldn't tell me. He just kept saying, never mind that, we're going to be paid. And I have noticed in many of the meetings he's been to that this is one of the things that he is really standing up and wanting to be heard about, is the fact that they're going to be paid union wages. This is fine. I think they should definitely be paid union wages for what they do, if they are doing it a good job at it. But I think by the same token that these people would have a great deal more personal pride, village pride, and would certainly feel much better toward the teachers and the people who are going into the village teaching them things, if the Native paid for part of this. Granted, they cannot pay full price for many things, because don't forget, they have huge families. These people, some of them have 12, 14, and I remember delivering a 19th baby for one woman. And this takes money to support them, to send them to school, to buy clothes, to buy books. And if these people were to pay for everything that they get, it would be almost impossible. But I think they should be allowed to pay part of it. In my particular work, we help them get glasses when their vision becomes poor. And this is not a giveaway program. They must pay for them. We have a contract with the American Optical Company, and we get them very reasonable for them. But they have to pay for them. And the public health service doctor goes out into the villages and examines their eyes and writes the prescription for their glasses. But it is their responsibility to get the money order, to mail the money order into Juneau, and it must be for the full amount. And they do it. They plan on it. And when the public health nurse goes into the village and does the rough Snellen test of their vision and tells them that they're going to need glasses. She at the same time tells them about how much it will cost. We cannot tell exactly because they pick out the kind of glasses they want, and they all have a different price. But if we give them an idea, they have it. When the doctor gets there, they pull it out of their pockets and they have the money ready to pay for them. So that I know that if they had the privilege of paying, many times they would pay. I think of another time when a hearing aid was bought for a child, that the child needed a hearing aid, and we have connections with many of the social agencies that they help us with those hearing aids. They cost in the neighborhood of $150 to $300, depending on what type the doctor feels the patient should have. And we paid for it outright. And it wasn't taken care of. It was left outdoors. It was lying around the house. They did not get new batteries. I feel certain that if those people had had the privilege of paying $10 or $15 or $20 or one mink skin or one beaver skin for those glasses, that they would have had much better care and the child would have worn them, worn the hearing aid. I feel that the native is going to go a long ways in school. We are already getting natives into our higher education. More and more are going to college. More and more are going into politics. I am very proud to be able to say that I know one of the state legislators who has gone through school, through high school at Mount Edgecombe, is now a student at the University of Alaska, and is representing his people in the state legislature. I know two other boys from the Bethel area that came from very, very poor homes where neither mother nor father could speak English, and both of these boys are now teaching high school here in the state of Alaska. There are many more of these, but these are ones that I know personally, and I remember their backgrounds and know their backgrounds so well. I have a great deal of feeling for these people who have done so well. To go on with my history, after being in this area in Fairbanks and enjoying so much the new people and the new villages that I met, I had the sad experience of having another heart attack on the 6th of November with a mild cardiac arrest, which means, of course, that I can no longer go on with this kind of work that I love so much. And so it is felt best for not only myself, but for the state of Alaska, that they be relieved of their responsibilities and that I get into some easier kind of work and take better care of this old heart that is gradually wearing out. I have many marvelous memories. I have cases and cases of slides. I have an Alaska library that I have tried to buy the best books that are printed of the history and the background of the people and the stories of their advances in this education that we're trying to give them.
Thank you. A very interesting story, well told. Joe Mlardy, Dana Yukon Historical Society.